Well, so one of the guys in the study missed every single fearful expression. I mean, it's a multiple choice study, so they have to guess something. Usually they just guess a little randomly. Surprise, anger, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
And he knew he was doing badly. Apparently he did realize. He was like, I feel like I'm not getting these. And he got to the last fearful expression in the set. And he says, you know, I don't know what that expression is called, but I know that's what people look like right before you stab them. But imagine that. Yeah. I mean, it's a really profound empathic deficit when you think about it that way, that he's like, oh yeah, I've seen this before. I know I've seen people look like that before. And I've seen them look like that in a situation where they thought they were going to die because I was going to stab them. That, I think it's just so revealing about how people who are very psychopathic are just kind of stumped when it comes to certain basic emotions in others that they don't experience themselves.
This is The Way Podcast.
The militias needed to have a heads up that I was coming.
I personally think that it, you know, like in chess.
So that's how deep the addiction goes.
I've been incarcerated most of my life.
Having a conversation with
Bill. They've been given no option, either join or die.
Snipers, and it was a military.
J. Cole came and hung out most of the choir session. I'm standing at the studio glass looking out into the studio.
If you want to know more about The Way Podcast, go to podcasttheway.com.
This is Bill with The Way Podcast on FM 91.7, WHUS Doors at the top of the hour, and also 90.3 WRIU South Kingston at the top of the hour. Today, I'll be talking with Dr. Abigail Marsh. She is a professor in the Department of Psychology and the Interdisciplinary Neuroscience Program at Georgetown University, where she directs the Laboratory on Social and Affective Neuroscience, where she researches empathy and the range from altruism to psychopathy. Be sure to give the show a 5-star rating, review, like, share the show. Every little bit helps. You can go to podcasttheway.com for more information. Again, podcasttheway.com. What even got you into this topic? I did a little introduction for the audience so they know what today's topic is. But what even made you want to dive into this and research this for a career path?
Well, my sort of earliest interest in why people care about other people and empathy and altruism and all the topics related to that probably traces back to an incident that happened when I was a teenager. I was about 19 and I was in a car accident and a stranger saved my life. The slightly longer version of it is that I was driving down a big freeway, Interstate 5 in Washington State, where I grew up, one summer around midnight. And as I was crossing an overpass back into my hometown, a very small dog darted out in front of my car. I did the wrong thing I know now, which is I swerved to avoid it. And that sent my car first fishtailing and then ultimately spinning in big donuts across the freeway.
Yeah, that's one of the worst decisions you have to make because you're supposed to continue straight, but I'm a strong animal lover, so I don't even know if I could. I think I'd have to do the same thing you did.
It was horrible. I did run over the dog, even despite swerving, and it made me just feel ill thinking about it for a very long time afterwards. I love dogs, so that was horrible. There were many horrible parts of the evening, but that was one of them. And the combination of then swerving and running over the dog, I think, is what sent my car out of control. Anyway, so we careen out of control. Car ends up spinning around and winds up in the fast lane of the freeway facing backward into the oncoming traffic. And I'm on this overpass that had no shoulders, so I had nowhere to go and I had no phone because it was the 90s. I just sat there in the car. I remember I turned on my brights and I turned on my flashers, so at least the oncoming cars would see me sooner. But, you know, I was just past the crest of this overpass. So they were swerving out of the way just barely in time. And the car would shake every time a car went by. And I knew it was just a matter of time until.
Well, it's been terrifying.
It was. It felt surreal at the moment. And it feels even more surreal thinking back on it. Like, did that really happen? It did. Yeah. I mean, I'm not going to lie. But it didn't feel, it felt like it. Different kind of mental headspace, no question. Anyways, so I don't know how long I sat there because it didn't the whole thing felt so surreal. But anyway, eventually I heard a knock on the passenger side window of the car, and there was a man standing there when I turned to look. And, you know, it was one of those things. Just one more surreal thing that happened this evening. There's a man standing on this overpass outside my car. And I later figured out that he had seen me stranded there and would have had, you know, less than a second to decide that instead of just driving by, he was going to stop and try to help me. And so he had pulled his car onto the stripey section by an exit ramp on the other side of the freeway and then run in the dark across the freeway through traffic to get to me. Knowing nothing about me, I don't think he could possibly have seen me in the car. Anyways, so I think I remember what he looked like. I don't know if I would recognize him if I saw him again, but I would definitely recognize his voice. He had a very reassuring voice, and he said, you look like you could use some help.
Oh, what a quote.
Yes, I could. Yeah. And I said, yes, I think I could. And he said, do you mind if I come sit in your seat? And I remember the improbable thought flashing through my head of, oh no, this is my mom's car. I'm not supposed to let anybody else drive it. And being like, you know what? More pressing problems to worry about. Anyway, so then he had to run around the car back into traffic again, get in the car. And then I had scooched over and he realized that the car was still in drive, which is why I hadn't been able to get it turned back on. And then he, you know, hit the gas and got us back across the freeway to safety, relative safety behind his car, which I remember being a very nice BMW. That's my memory of it. Dark gray, nice BMW. Interestingly.
Yeah.
Funny the details you remember.
Were you in like shock? Do you not know what's happening? Yes. So you need him to just be that leader?
Well, I know now more about what happens in situations like these, and you get very hyper-focused on whatever the main thing is that you're focusing on, but all the peripheral stuff kind of gets fuzzy. So for example, people who've been held up at gunpoint will say that they can remember every detail of what the gun itself looked like because that's what they're looking at.
Yeah.
But then everything else around that can get a little fuzzy.
Yeah, I remember I was talking to somebody about the operation after 9/11. It was like the first soldier to die in that war. And these prisoners, like all of them broke out of their cells. It was chaos. It was this crazy mess. And that's what he said. He just remembers seeing this gun come out in slow motion. All he saw was the gun and the person. And he's just thinking like, why is he shooting at me? What's he didn't realize like, oh wait, I'm his enemy.
Right. And I feel like you do get this weird sensation of the world slowing down. Because you're thinking so fast. I feel now I know also that when you're in this emergency situation, you're thinking, you're like every system in your body is on high alert. You think really fast. And so it almost makes everything else seem to be slow by comparison. Yeah. And so I remember how bad I was shaking by the time we got back to safety. And I remember being just like clammy. Yeah. And him saying, I remember he offered to follow me home. He said, you don't look like you're doing so well. Do you need me to follow you for a little while to make sure you get home all right? And I remember being like, no, I'll be okay. And, I was really not. I'm 99% sure I didn't say thank you at any point, which plagues me to this day. But again, that's just how rattled I was and just so unsure of the whole thing. I wish that I had said, please do follow me home. I want to know your name. I want to know why did you do this? Like if I could go back in time and talk to him, but
invite him for dinner, have a whole understanding.
Yeah. I would love to be, you know, one of those heartwarming stories where, you know, the person and their rescuer become lifelong friends, and that just didn't happen. But anyways, so he said, okay, well, you take care of yourself. And off he went, you know, got back in his car and drove off. And that's the last I ever saw or heard of him. And of course, I've been asked before, you know, do you think you'll ever meet him? And I said, you know, I don't know. Every time I talk about him, I hope that he might hear. But, I really don't know how old he was at the time. He was a Black man with a shaved head, and he was probably in his 30s, but you know, everybody looks a million years old when you're 19. So, you know, he could have been 60. I have absolutely no idea. And so I just, you know, I hope he's still out there and maybe one day I'll get to meet him, but I don't know.
Same, fingers crossed. I'm sure he knows that you're saying thank you or you're thankful. I mean,
I hope so. I hope so. He can, yeah, he can, he knows what he did. I mean, I hope he understood the gravity and the real beauty of what he did.
And in terms of that chaotic, just like trying to understand what he did, that's what made you want to follow this path. Why do people do this?
Yeah, I mean, it's not, nothing is as linear as that in the moment. It was only really looking back that I could see how all the paths sort of fit and sort of aligned after that incident, where, you know, I had already started taking classes in psychology and realized how much I just loved psychology. And then when I was trying to come up with a project for my honors undergrad thesis a year or so later. And so anyways, I was interested in psychology, and right after it happened, I just couldn't get rid of the thought of like, why did this happen? Like, what is it that I owe my life to? I just can't believe this happened to me. I used to get in a lot of funny scrapes when I was younger, though. I'm not really sure why. I had a real knack for it. So it wasn't the only scrape like that that I had opportunity to wonder about, but it was certainly the only one where I, you know, owed my life to, it was basically the only one I really owe my life to strangers. So, And so then as I progressed in psychology, I started, you know, I was taking topics related to social behavior. These are the classes I was taking, and emotion, and trying to understand what makes people tick. And then when it came time to do my honors thesis, the topic I came up with was, you know, why it is that we respond to people who are afraid with care. And it's like, that's clearly related to this incident, right? Why do people who are afraid make us want to help them? You know, I don't even know if I knew the connection at the time, but looking back, it's pretty clear.
Yeah, so in your research, fear actually becomes a big topic. I actually didn't even realize it, but I think people who are on the opposite side, like a psychopathic, they don't even, they don't sense fear. Like, they don't have that same emotion, while people who are empathetic have a stronger sense of fear.
Yeah. So the degree to which people experience fear varies a lot. I mean, we all know this, right? Because some people are willing to do things, you know, watching like Alex Honnold, for example, climb, you know, a half mile high cliff with no ropes. You know, obviously he's not feeling in that moment what I would be feeling, because what I would be feeling would make it impossible to do that climb. Now, what's interesting is he's not fearless. He's obviously not fearless, because I've heard him talk about his experiences in a way that makes it clear he's not fearless, but he's really good at compartmentalizing his fear, which is different. And he has his love of climbing and the joy that he takes in it and his passion for doing it are much stronger than his
fear. Just overwhelms any fear he has.
Exactly. And that's a really important lesson, I think, is that there's a difference between being brave and being fearless. Being brave is being somebody who's capable of fear, and yet you're willing to do something anyhow that makes you afraid, because it's more important than the fear. And that's true whether you're doing something, you know, sort of a great human accomplishment that's risky, like what Alex Honnold is doing, or it's true for heroes too, like the man who rescued me. Yeah, I think it does him a great disservice to call him fearless.
Yeah, because I was going to say, like, oh, well, then from your research, it seems like people who are psychopathic tend to not experience fear, but he probably experienced fear. He was just able to overcome it.
Yeah, exactly. And so what we know is that people vary a lot in the likelihood that they'll experience fear in an actually risky situation. And that people who are relatively fearless, it's not like they experience absolutely zero fear ever, but their fear response is really muted compared to the average person, are at higher risk for being psychopathic. So that is one of the sort of ingredients of a psychopathic personality, is being relatively cool, verging on cold in the face of danger. That alone isn't enough to make somebody psychopathic, but it's a big part of it. And one of the reasons is that people who are insensitive to fear don't empathize with other people's fear either, right? If you don't really feel fear strongly, you can imagine how if somebody else is feeling fear, you might have trouble understanding why they're feeling, what they would want in that moment.
It'd be like, if I never saw the color green, I wouldn't understand somebody seeing the color green.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. And we know, for example, that there are studies of people who have a disorder called congenital insensitivity to pain. They're very rare, because to be truly insensitive to pain is very dangerous, because pain obviously keeps us alive, keeps us away from things that hurt us. But anyways, and people who have this insensitivity do have more trouble empathizing with other people's pain. They're like, what could that be that you're feeling when you step on a nail or put your hand on a hot stove? They've never felt pain. So not, at least not externally generated pain. And so it makes sense that if you don't feel fear strongly, then other people's fear is a bit of a mystery to you. And it's to the point that people with psychopathy have trouble even recognizing when somebody's afraid from looking at their face or hearing their voice. So, you know, like great, big, vivid, fearful expressions that most people could recognize really easy or easily. Somebody who has psychopathy would just look at it and be like, I don't know, what would you call that? In fact, I have a colleague in the UK who was testing people who were psychopathic and who were offenders. So these were in prison psychopaths. They were, you know, very high levels of psychopathy. And she was testing their ability to recognize different facial expressions in a standard psychology test. And the people who were psychopathic did okay with most expressions, but they really struggled to recognize other people's fear, because again, that's the one emotion they seem to be really quite muted in. Well, the one she was testing.
Anyhow, they had no idea, or do they just see it as a weird, could they even guess what the expression was?
Well, so one of the guys in the study missed every single fearful expression. I mean, it's a multiple choice study, so they have to guess something. Usually they just guess a little randomly, surprise, anger, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
And he knew he was doing badly. Apparently he did realize that he's like, I feel like I'm not getting these. And he got to the last fearful expression in the set. And he says, you know, I don't know what that expression is called, but I know that's what people look like right before you stab them. Imagine that. Yeah. I mean, it's a really profound empathic deficit when you think about it that way, that he's like, oh yeah, I've seen this before. I know I've seen people look like that before. Mm. And I've seen them look like that in a situation where they thought they were going to die because I was going to stab them. And what would you call that emotion? Like, I faced the situation, like I put it all together, I got nothing. Yeah. Right. And I think it's just so revealing about how people who are very psychopathic are just kind of stumped when it comes to certain basic emotions and others that they don't experience themselves. And so you can see how being unable to understand when other people are afraid would put you at higher risk for all sorts of bad behaviors, certainly being less likely to help people who are afraid, because you're like, what is there a problem? Like, I don't know, is something wrong? But also being less likely to inhibit the kinds of behaviors that cause fear in others. Because most of us, when we, you know, imagine doing something that might really hurt somebody, just even thinking about it, we internally simulate their feeling. That's what empathy is. You know, we generate a little internal representation of their emotion. And we're like, ooh, that's not good. Wouldn't want to make them feel like that, depending. Maybe it's somebody you hate, and then that's a different circumstance. But for the most part, the thought of causing somebody else to feel abject terror is very unpleasant for most people. We understand that that's a terrible feeling to make somebody feel, and that helps us know not to do the things that cause it.
And is there like a sort of morbid curiosity to it, in the sense that the news is very, Ukraine, Russia is understandably big news, and like it's a very serious topic, but it seems like the news brings out a lot of negatives, like, oh, shootings on the rise, violence on the rise, all of this, because we feel compelled to watch it. Is that like a part of the reason why we always have to watch this news?
Well, it is true that certain emotions are more sort of activating. So anger and fear, for example, are two very activating emotions. They you know, increase your level of physiological arousal, where you're sort of amped up and, you know, that sort of fight or flight state. Most people tend to be pretty vigilant for threats in the environment, because you need to be, you know, thinking about it sort of evolutionarily. It's very adaptive to be attuned to potential threats in your environment and want to learn about them so that you can avoid them. You know, learning that everything's just fine is not evolutionarily that useful. Now the problem is that, like, in most of the industrialized world, most of the time people are okay, right? The average lifespan is like 80-ish. Obviously that varies a lot, a lot, but it's pretty consistent. And it's certainly a lot longer than, you know, any of our ancestors would have lived 10,000 years ago. And so, you know, the way the media reflects the world is not an accurate depiction of the world, which we know, but our brains are very attuned to potential threats around us because that's a very adaptive way to be. And the media knows that. And so the media amplifies how much scary stuff they depict, because that's what draws people in and keeps them watching and feeling like, oh, now I'm going to be prepared to deal with these threats. Yeah, so it's a very unhealthy cycle.
Yeah, your research, I saw that people who are in better situations themselves tend to be more empathetic because they're okay, they can help out others. But then if I see like everybody's looking at the same detrimental media, everybody's looking at the same negative things, or life just getting worse for everybody, then it seems to be that cycle, like you just said, of like continuous, I guess, empathy going downward, like a downward trend.
Yeah, no, people are not their best selves in general under conditions of serious threat or deprivation. Now, they're better than people think. I mean, one of the ongoing frustrations of altruism researchers like myself is that, you know, people unfortunately have come to take the Lord of the Flies book literally. You know, they just believe that in situations of extreme threat and deprivation, that's what will happen, is it's each person out for themselves against everybody else until they're all dead, or until somebody dies. Not to give away the plot, but
spoiler.
You know, right. There have been really interesting real life examples of people, like including there was a group of schoolboys who were marooned on an island. I think it was off Australia for some period of time, and it's exactly the opposite thing that happens. People are very good at banding together out of necessity with, you know, their sort of their group, because that is, you know, that's what humans need. We are a weak and feeble species physically compared to any other similarly sized mammal. We really need each other to survive. However, under threatening circumstances, people don't tend to treat people outside of their group very well, right? It's that exact instinct to sort of circle the wagons and band together with those that you are, you know, the most dependent on for survival. And that's a very healthy, necessary response to being under serious duress. But understandably, in that situation, you don't have a lot of resources to help people, you know, that you're not directly dependent on. So anyway, yes, there's research that suggests that when people are sort of in times of plenty and things are going well and they have, you know, enough, this increases well-being. Not surprisingly, people tend to report like, yeah, my life is going pretty well. When
I'd hope so.
Like that's right. I mean, that only makes sense. I mean, it's not the only things that matter. I mean, you need social connections, you need health, et cetera. But anyways, so in general, when life is going better, people report a higher sense of well-being. And yes, there's a really a positive relationship between having higher levels of well-being and being pro-social, helping other people, especially people who are not that close to you. So volunteering for charities, donating to charities, giving blood, helping non-human animals, things that you don't have to do for survival, but that are just helping other people just because you want to help them or animals. Well-being, a sense of positive well-being seems to promote those behaviors, which is great, because it would be horrible if it were the opposite, right? I mean, can you imagine if like the happier you are, the meaner you are to other people? It's like, oh no, it's like a horrible conflict then, but it doesn't seem to be that is the conflict.
Well, that's good. Feeding into that, helping other people. So you dive into altruism, which, correct me if I'm wrong, is pretty much the opposite of psychopathy. It's those people that are very empathetic. They just really want to help. In terms of like the research, what makes these people more, what stood out is like donating a kidney. Like what makes these people really push themselves almost secondary in a way, just to help strangers?
Yeah. So the research I did after being rescued focused a lot on different ways of understanding empathy and at least altruism in the laboratory. So, you know, donating money or volunteering to help somebody in the laboratory setting in a small way. Once I started my own lab at Georgetown, where I am now, I became much more interested in directly studying this question again. I want to know, when people are willing to sacrifice their life potentially to help a stranger, why is that? You know, let's look at altruism in the real world. Like really, and the reason I study people who are so-called extraordinary altruists who give kidneys to strangers or livers to strangers or, you know, rescue them from accidents is that it's not that I don't think giving blood isn't altruistic. I think it is. But there's a lot of reasons to donate blood. I mean, there are people who do blood drives because their organization is sponsoring it and they're just kind of there because, hey, there are people who donate blood, you know, because it's something they just sort of learn to do. And it's a very normative thing to do. If everybody's doing it, it's like, okay, I'll do it too.
Yeah. There's also like plasma for money. You get like $100 or something.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And donating money to charity is great. And, you know, giving a stranger directions. These are all behaviors that I think can be motivated by altruism, but they can be motivated by a lot of other things as well, including just desire to do the normative thing, which all of us are extremely responsive to. Things that you've learned to do along the way or that you've been explicitly taught to do. And so the reason I like studying very non-normative behaviors like donating a kidney to a stranger is because nobody taught you to do that, right?
Like, give up a kidney.
It's not normative. And so you're not just following along what other people are doing. You don't even know your recipient when you're going into a donation, like a kidney donation. And so, you know, you can't be expecting something in return from them. And so it's really hard to come up with any reason that you would do something like give a kidney to a stranger or save them in an accident, other than you just wanted to help them, because all the other potential motivations are pretty much non-existent. And so if you really want to understand core altruism, why people care about others and want to help them for their own sake, it's a really good group of people to work with. And so I've had the very, very good fortune to work with quite a large number now of people who have given kidneys to strangers or a piece of their liver to strangers, and then some other altruists over the last couple of years. And yeah, what we found out about them is that they're sort of the opposite of people who are psychopathic in a number of key ways. I think the most interesting, and because it's a little bit counterintuitive, is that people who are altruistic are extremely sensitive to other people's fear. So just as people with psychopathy are insensitive to it, people who are altruistic are more sensitive to it. And again, this comes back to the idea that being altruistic is not the same thing as being fearless. They are sensitive to what fear is. They understand it. They empathize with it.
Quick question. When you say people's fear, do you mean like me just looking at someone else's fear? Or would that person be more afraid to just watch scary movies too, like any fear in general?
Right. And so they certainly are good at empathizing with other people's fear. Do they feel fear more strongly than average? They certainly feel fear at least as strongly as the average person. And almost none of the altruistic kidney donors I've worked with are particularly risk-taking people. But there are a couple exceptions, interestingly. But for the most part, these are not people who go around taking risks for their own sake. And so neither are they, you know, basket cases, nervous wrecks, not at all. But they certainly are acutely sensitive to what it means to feel afraid. And so then when they encounter somebody else who's afraid, they get it, they understand, they empathize with them. and that seems to be due in part to differences in the function and the structure of a brain structure called the amygdala that we study with our brain scanning approaches. And in altruists, the amygdala is more active in response to the sight of somebody else's fear. In altruists, and it also is larger in altruists than it is in typical adults. Whereas in people who are psychopathic, we see exactly the opposite. So the structure is less responsive to others' fear and it tends to be smaller. So some, you know, there's a lot of unanswered questions when it comes to brain imaging studies. Why is any of this true? What is the amygdala doing exactly? I mean, I have speculations, but I don't know for sure yet. But it really does suggest the existence of this, what I call a caring continuum, that there is a spectrum of care in the world out there, with some people being unusually caring and altruistic, partly because of these differences in the structure and function of their brain and how it makes them respond to others' distress. And then there's most of us that sit comfortably in the middle, who are certainly capable of care and compassion. We just may not experience them quite as strongly. And then there's at the other extreme end, people who are psychopathic, who are pretty uncaring as well due to some issues with their brains.
So this amygdala is the primary indicator, but I have to imagine there's other parts of the brain that are sort of dictating care and empathy.
Yes, for sure. The amygdala doesn't do anything by itself. You know, it's really one of both the challenges and the frustrations, and also the exciting parts of studying the brain is that it's, you know, everything's talking to everything else all the time. And so trying to isolate, you know, what each region or what each circuit does is hard. And you can't ever do it with a brain imaging study alone. You have to say, okay, well, these are my hypotheses based on what we know about people who've had strokes or brain damage that knocks out certain kinds of functions. This is what we know based on the animal literature, because of course the amygdala does functionally the same thing in a rat or a monkey or a cat as it does in a person. It's a very ancient structure. And so together, all of that evidence together suggests what the amygdala is doing is it does many things, but one of the things it does is coordinate the experience of fear through its connections to all these other structures in the brain. And it can respond in different ways, though. It's not like a dumb, inflexible structure. It can respond, it can sort of, it's like kind of like a train switching tracks in a rail yard, right? So the amygdala calculates that there's some sort of danger present. And cells within it seem to be able to help determine whether you then go down the track of self-preservation. I run away, I freeze, you know, from the danger, I run away, I try to get out of there. Or if this danger is threatening others around me, the amygdala could calculate the same presence of danger, but instead switch you to the track of you need to go help. And there's really cool rodent studies that suggest that there are populations of cells within the amygdala that seem to be responsible for making that determination. Again, not alone, but if you knock them out, for example, rats will only respond in a self-preserving way to danger. They will not, for example, act to help their pups. I talk a lot about the amygdala because one thing I learned very early on in brain imaging is that nobody understands the entire brain. It's impossible. Yeah. Like, it's just too complicated. It was actually the most reassuring thing I remember when I first started brain imaging. It was my very first brain imaging presentation. I was at the National Institute of Health and I was doing an imaging study that I was presenting related to how people respond to status cues. So cues that somebody's high status versus low status. And it was just a little, very simple study. And I went into this meeting of neuroscientists to present my data, and the acronym for the meeting was ANGST. I don't even know what it stood for, but it was exactly how I was feeling when I went into this meeting. So all these very, you know, luminaries of neuroscience to present my research findings. And I got about 5 minutes into my talk about this brain imaging study, and this one very eminent esteemed neuroscientist started arguing with my advisor, who was another eminent esteemed neuroscientist, about, you know, which layer of this part of the cortex has reciprocal connections to some other part of the cortex that I'd never even heard of at the time. And, you know, and as they all were talking, I realized that none of them know the answer to everything. They all have little pockets of knowledge. And it's only by talking together that we can understand the whole question, because it's just so complicated. And it really reinforced to me why it's so important that science, especially really complex sciences like neuroscience, be team events. There's no way anybody can do this kind of work by themselves successfully.
Yeah.
And I should emphasize, I have benefited throughout my career from fantastic teams of both advisors and all my students and trainees.
Yeah, I bet. And I remember I read this book called Range. Like, it's all about like generalism. I feel like with the book, you have to be generalist, like about the whole brain. You can't specialize and say, I'm an expert on the amygdala. I know exactly how it works. It's like, well, no, the water flows here and here. The synapses, everything. So I can picture that.
Yeah. There's some probably balance, I think. I don't try to know as much about every structure of the brain as I know about the amygdala. I will simply admit that I do not know as much about the hippocampus as I know about the amygdala. I do not know as much about the our pituitary. But I know some about them. And if I didn't know anything about them, you know, I would not be able to answer the questions about the things I care about most. You have to specialize to some degree. I mean, you know, like I said, the amygdala is an incredibly complicated structure. And I have a book this thick called Just Amygdala.
Well, I'd hope my doctor would specialize on like the human body versus car mechanics too. I get that.
But I mean, you know, for example, you have an internist who sort of is like the whole body. But then if you need if you have kidney disease, I hope you'll see a nephrologist whose, you know, specialization is the kidney. And I wouldn't have that person help you with your, eyes. But you want them to know about something more than just your kidneys too, of course.
Definitely. I get that. In terms of the amygdala, if somebody has a bigger one and they're more altruistic, would they be more prone to let their emotion overwhelm their brain at times? There's people who are like are led by emotions or brains and like thought processes? Are psychopaths more brain oriented, like mental calculations, versus somebody else who just, they might do something completely wrong, but their emotions overwhelm them?
I think it's more which emotions are overwhelming you. So people who are psychopathic can get overwhelmed by emotions like anger or excitement seeking. And in fact, often when they get into the most trouble is when they are letting their anger or their desire for excitement and stimulation get the better of them. But they're not ever going to be overwhelmed by emotions like love, or guilt or fear. And so I think your ability to regulate your emotions is sort of a separate thing from the kinds of emotions that bubble up most strongly. People who are very altruistic don't really seem to differ that much from other people in their ability to regulate emotions. And we've actually looked at that specifically in them. So it's not so much that they let their emotions get the better of them. It's just the kinds of emotions they're more likely to feel are a little different.
Gotcha. Yeah, that surprised me a little bit.
Huh. I will say that, I mean, sort of related to that is that most people who are very altruistic, when they say, when you ask them how they made the altruistic decision they made, they usually say it was very fast, that they, it's not like they were like weighing the costs and balances of giving a kidney to somebody. They might do that later, but the initial sort of decision to give a kidney, they usually say is, you know, well, when I found out I could do this, I wanted to do it. yeah. And which again, I think is consistent with it being kind of a deep, emotionally motivated decision. It's not, it wasn't some sort of logical analysis.
Yeah, that's very interesting. And building off of that part, does, say I have a small amygdala or I'm just like a not caring person, or say the opposite, if I start donating money or if I start helping charities, even though I don't want to, will that part of my brain grow, or will I slowly become more altruistic, or vice versa?
It's possible. We don't have a ton of evidence on that, but maybe. And there's a couple of reasons we think that could be true. One is that we know that helping other people, especially if you help them because you want to help them. So for example, if you're a high school student who's doing some community service project because you have to for your course credit, but you don't really want to be there and you're not really engaged in the whole purpose of it, you know, that's not going to change you in any fundamental way. However, when people engage in helping behavior because they actually want to do it, I'm going to help somebody because I want to help them, that does increase your well-being. So that's incontrovertible. We know that if you expend money or resources helping people, you will be happier afterwards than if you hadn't. And we know that well-being increases prosociality. And so it seems like you could get into a nice reciprocal cycle. Maybe that would be reflected in changes in brain structure and function. It probably would be. Although as far as we know, that's never been measured. And now that I think about it, that would be a great study.
If you make that a study, give me a little citation.
I will explicitly mention you in the acknowledgments. There's another possibility, which is that there's some evidence that this, and it's not really related to well-being exactly, although it's such a separate line of research, I'm not sure it's ever been directly tested, but there's lots of research with animals that giving care begets more care. So for example, rats are not very good parents at baseline. So for example, female rats, before they've ever had their own pregnancy or their own pups, really don't like rat pups. They will avoid them. They will sometimes even attack them or even eat them. They just don't like them. And then, but once a female rat gets pregnant for the first time and has her own litter of babies, instantly she transitions to being a really good caregiver. And in fact, she'll care for any rat pup that comes her way at that point. Her rat pup, anybody, somebody else's rat pup, who cares? She will, and rat pup, mother rats will cross like electrified grids to reach their pups. They'll forgo food and water to help their pups. I mean, they're really, really caring. And this is important because we think that the parental care circuitry is the sort of foundation for all kinds of altruistic care since then. In any case, but what's also interesting is that if you take a adult rat who has never had pups before, even a male rat, interestingly, and male rats don't usually do any pup care, and you just kind of force them to interact with pups and just kind of be around them and be just kind of a caring presence, eventually they'll get with the program and they'll want to start taking care. And this seems to be the case for all different kinds of care, that the taking care of others get the parental care sort of circuitry activated, which then produces more care. And so it seems to be a self-reinforcing cycle in a way. So yes, I think that, you know, when people ask me, well, how can I develop my altruism? How can I become a more caring person? There's more than one way to do it. But one of the recommendations I give is just start, you know, just do something helpful. Like next time you see somebody that needs help, just pitch in. Because so many of the altruists I work with have said that, you know, they were blood donors first, and they love giving blood and feeling that they knew that they were helping people who were, and you know, who were really ill and really needed their blood. And then, you know, sometimes that transitioned to marrow donation, and you know, they signed up to give bone marrow. Some have actually given bone marrow or stem cells. And then, you know, by the time the opportunity to donate a kidney arose, they were like, well, that just seemed like a natural thing too. It's just taking care of others builds on itself over time.
I picture it like working out, like, oh, it's tough to go to the gym that first time. But like, the more you do it, the more you're like, oh, I like working out. It's easy. Yeah,
exactly. Because it is rewarding. Helping other people is rewarding. And it's funny. One of the most common things I hear people say in response to that is, oh, well, if helping other people is so rewarding, that it's not altruistic, it's just selfish. To which I would say yes, which means the very most selfish people among us are the ones who donate kidneys, right? Take us to altruism. It's the most, right? Which is obviously silly. Yeah. But even beyond that, I would say far from helping other people being rewarding, meaning that helping is selfish, it's exactly the opposite, because I think being rewarded and finding it rewarding to help other people is the definition of what it means to be altruistic. Because if we weren't altruistic, why would we find helping other people rewarding? Right. It's almost like a, it would be impossible. Like if you weren't a person who cared about other people, then you certainly wouldn't find helping them rewarding. And that is true about people who are psychopathic, for example. They love pleasure. They love doing things that are enjoyable, but they never find enjoyment in helping other people. They find enjoyment in helping themselves. And so I think it's really important to remember that we find gratification and pleasure in helping other people because we're altruistic.
That's really heartwarming, because that means what, like 99% of the population wants to help one another out. We like all literally kind of want to help each other out. We get happy doing that.
At baseline, under the best circumstances, yes. I think most people are certainly capable of altruistic motivation. And I have only come to believe that more strongly the longer I've done this research. Now, and then people say, well, but yeah, look at all the horrible things that people do out there in the world. And I say, yes, well, some of those people are the 1% that we hear about disproportionately, because that's the way the media makes money. Yeah. And then people unfortunately extrapolate from, you know, hearing a lot about that 1% to thinking, well, people must be terrible. It's like, no. There are some people who are pretty terrible in terms of their motivations, but that's not people. People are different. But in addition, even people who have the capacity to be good people also have the capacity to be bad people, because other motivations sometimes crowd in. I mean, the worst kind of motivation, well, that's not true. There are many bad motivations out there. But one of the most frustrating circumstances is when people are motivated to hurt people out of a sense of altruism, right? And I'm sure nobody can think of anything related to this that's happened in the popular culture recently. But when somebody hurts somebody because they believe that they're protecting somebody that they care about, and that is a very deep old kind of altruism. Now, I am certainly not going to be the person to say that the violence is ever justifiable necessarily, whatever the motivation. But we know that, again, for animal studies, that maternal aggression is one of the really sort of most essential forms of altruistic care. Mothers protecting their pups. I mean, everybody knows that, right? Don't get between a mother bear and her cubs. And that kind of aggression is not born out of the desire to be cruel. It's born out of a desire to protect those that you love. But this also functions at a much higher level when it comes to groups. For example, like if some leader convinces me that my group is somehow under threat from your group over there, who I barely even know, and I've just been taught all sorts of horrible things about you, well, then I'm perfectly happy to go out and do horrible things to you in that other group because I have come to believe that my group is under great threat. I'm protecting myself. I'm protecting my group. You know, that's where really horrible atrocities come from.
Yeah, that's such an odd situation because I remember a while ago, I talked with Dr. Mia Bloom and her research is on like QAnon. And she wrote a book about how a lot of families are separating. And it's kind of heartbreaking when a lot of QAnon folks, the reason they're in it and the reason they go down this rabbit hole is because they believe that there's this whole child ring, kids getting abducted thing that's not happening. But it's that same empathy. And then they look at their family like, what's wrong with you? Don't you see these kids being abducted? Don't you care?
Do you remember the guy who came to Comet Ping Pong in DC? Do you remember this happened several years ago? I think it was 5 years ago. 4 years ago. Yeah, there was a man who drove up from North Carolina to Comet Ping Pong in DC, where I live. And he brought his I think he brought his AR-17, like some
that wasn't a pizza
semi-automatic
place.
Rifle. Yeah. Yeah.
It was the pizza
place. It's called Comet Ping Pong, but it's a pizza place. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's actually where I had my book party once upon a time.
Nice. Yeah. Not at the same time, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. We just had to like, you know, no, but like the horrible thing was, I mean, so I think that was after my book party was there, but anyways, he really thought he was protecting abused children and he went and shot up a pizza joint where, you know, believe me, there are no children being abused. There isn't even a basement, which is where he thought the children were being abused. There is no basement. You know, so here's this man who was convinced, you know, by who even knows, into doing something really terrible where he could have killed people because he thought he was protecting other people. That's that the reason I say that's one of the worst motivations. It's not because it's the worst motivation. It's a complicated motivation, but it's really hard to uproot, right? Because it's based in altruism, which we don't want to get rid of. But it's based in obviously false beliefs created by malign actors. And it is rooted in this tendency for humans who believe that there are threatening forces in the world around them to, again, want to sort of band together with those that they believe that they can trust and depend on to get the whatever those malign outside forces are. It's tough stuff.
Yeah, it makes me think like that's sort of the root of the biggest thing seems to be politics, where like people are separate on every issue and that feeds into one side hitting the other. And then QAnon, it seems like every issue seems to boil down to altruism being taken advantage of or just miscommunicated.
Yeah. And I will say that I can't tell you how often I've heard people ask me if the altruists I work with are X group that they're a part of. So a very religious person might say, well, surely all the altruists are, you know, of my denomination. Somebody who's a, you know, a very progressive Democrat might say, well, I have to imagine these are not Republicans that you're studying. and one of the unfortunate things of our current information ecosystem is that people have been convinced that people are much more different in terms of their fundamental values than they are. And so what I find so frustrating is that actually 90% of people in America believe mostly the same thing when it comes to core issues. I mean, not every issue, I know this, but you know, when it comes to like most gun laws, for example, 90% of people-ish believe basically the same thing. And that's true for a lot of big political issues, that that there are vested interests, you know, political, I don't know, actors, in convincing us that we are enemies to each other, because that's the way you can get people to act on behalf of that other group in ways that they wouldn't normally. And so we are being convinced by this media ecosystem that those other people over there are a threat, and that we certainly shouldn't help them, we shouldn't trust them, we shouldn't like them, even though if we actually had a conversation with them, we'd discover that we have a lot more in common than we have that's different.
It almost feels cliche with how much I hear between like family and friends, but it's like people at the top or whatever just want to split us apart so we can't all team up against, say, the evil person. We all think they're different people, but
follow the money. who's making money off convincing us that we are each other's enemies rather than, you know, in reality, each other's neighbors and coworkers and potential family and friends. It's a bummer, you know, because it doesn't have to be this way.
Definitely. Bringing it back a bit to altruism and some of your research, a question I have too is childhood? Like, are you born feeling a lot of empathy or psychopathic tendencies, or does it slowly develop as you grow in age?
Well, it's a little bit of both. You know, we know that there are differences in children when they're born. No two children are exactly alike. Isn't that wonderful? It would be so boring if it were otherwise. And some children start out a little more fearful, and some children start out a little more bold, and some are more reactive, and some are more curious. And that's always been true and always will be. And children who are at risk for psychopathy, for example, do seem to start out a little more fearless and a little less socially engaged. They seem less, a little less interested in people, a little less excited about affection, you know, things like hugs and snuggling. And I don't want to, you know, I've been a new mother myself. Like, no, nobody panic. My baby doesn't like to snuggle, you know, no worries. But it's very hard to pick up on these things in very young children. But, you know, when we look at big groups, you're like, yeah, kids at risk for psychopathy, that seems to be what their parents report. And then as they get older, those traits interact with the environment in ways that cause them to become psychopathic. So, for example, a child who's very fearless will tend to get in more scrapes. You know, they'll tend to do more things they're not supposed to do. They won't respond to punishment. So when you, and I'm not talking about physical punishment, I just mean, you know, a timeout. You know, they won't be afraid of getting a timeout, and so they won't inhibit their behavior to avoid it. And so over time, this can escalate into more and more extreme behavior that then parents feel really frustrated that they can't control. And that can lead to some negative parenting practices that then exacerbate the traits. And so it then spirals upwards into, in some cases, full-fledged psychopathy. And it's probably the same for people who are very altruistic. They probably start out a little more emotionally responsive, a little more socially sensitive. And then because they have these early tendencies, they're more likely to engage in helping behavior, comforting behavior, find out that's rewarding, and then sort of build up from there. That's the speculation. And so it's clear that both your innate capacities matter, but then so do the environments that you've been exposed to.
Gotcha. Some of that, each kid being born differently in the environment, is it hereditary too? I have to imagine, like, if you have two psychopathic parents, are you more likely just inherently to be born psychopathic, or vice versa?
It clearly does run in families. I mean, everything runs in families. Yeah. Depression runs in families. Schizophrenia runs in families. And so, yes, it doesn't mean that anything's guaranteed. So, for example, even if you have an identical twin that's schizophrenia, your odds of developing schizophrenia are only 50%. Okay. Right. And we know there's a very strong genetic component for schizophrenia. So there's a lot of unknowability in these things. But yes, if there are other people in your family who are psychopathic in your biological family, yes, you are more likely to develop psychopathy yourself. You know, it's unfortunately true.
Gotcha. This might be a little bit out of your realm of research, maybe a little left field-ish, but I know people who take acid or shrooms or psychedelics, they tend to love the world and everything about it. Does, like, the chemical reaction going on or something, does that inhibit, if say we all, obviously there's a lot of bad trips and a whole lot of negatives, and it's a whole topic in itself, but if we all tripped, would we all be more caring about one another?
This is a question that there are a lot of researchers asking right now. There's a few labs. There's one at Hopkins, there's one at Yale, there's a few others that are doing really interesting research looking at psychedelics. I think we're in the stage of the research where the hype is probably exceeding the reality. Like everything, psychedelics have different effects on different people because of, you know, it's true for every medicine, to be honest. Like, anybody who's ever taken an SSRI will say, yeah, that one didn't work for me at all, even though it did work for this other person over there. And there's, you know, it's unlikely to be different. Caffeine, even, you know, like, some people respond to it, some people don't. Anyhow, I think one of the things we don't understand yet, and a lot of my current research is really focusing on this question, is what does it mean to feel connected to another person or another creature, or even the whole world? You know, what does it mean to feel like you are fundamentally connected to them? They're connected to you. Their fate and yours are somehow cosmically intertwined. You know, in some ways, that's all that we mean when we talk about love. That is what it means to love somebody. And really, that's what altruism is all about. Is I fundamentally care about your welfare. It matters to me. I feel like your outcomes motivate me just as though they were my own outcomes. And so really that's all we've been talking about this whole talk is love in some form or another. And I think the ongoing question is there something interesting that happens when some people take psychedelics that causes them to develop a sense of connectedness to others around them that, you know, could reflect a sense of loving others, oneself, the universe, maybe. I don't know. I think there's some evidence that could be true. And I am, for one, very excited to find out.
And yeah, love, that wasn't even a thought to me, but it kind of should have been, is empathy and like altruism to the maximum, is love, that pure caring for one another emotion, like sounds like.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, like the scientific definition of love, which is a word I'm gradually getting less afraid of using in the scientific context. Because, you know, there's a bad reputation, like love research is so fluffy and, you know, yeah. It's not very hard science. But, you know, what is it if a mother takes care of her offspring and is willing to sacrifice herself to take care of it? I mean, if that's not love, I don't know what is, whether it's a rat or a dog or a person. The scientific definition of love is caring about the other's welfare for its own sake, not because of its instrumental value to you. You know, I care about, you know, whether you were happy or whether you were suffering, because that fundamentally matters to me, as though it were happening to me. That's what love is. And so I do think that there's a really deep connection between altruism and empathy and love that we really don't understand yet.
Gotcha. Not to make a joke, but then there's Kanye West, who really loves himself.
Well, speaking of psychological disorders, I mean, I think it's pretty well established he has bipolar disorder. Yeah. And people who are in the manic phase of the bipolar disorder can, you know, can do a lot of things that maybe aren't part of their core values. But, you know, mania is pretty close to psychosis in its extreme forms.
Gotcha. So,
I feel like everybody should really just take a 10-minute primer at some point in their life on like, what is bipolar disorder? I know plenty of people, you know, both friends and family members with bipolar disorder. And I, you know, people will be the first to say, like, I wasn't myself when I was doing all of this stuff. And it can be hard to treat. And I just, it's not, you know, it doesn't excuse it. It's different to say that person's completely excused versus I understand why they did what they did. And we need to look at it a little differently if it was in the middle of a manic episode, for example.
Yeah, I had a good friend who was like strong bipolar, where one moment, great guy. And he's always a great guy, but then he'll just randomly like punch a wall. And it's like, where did that come from? Like he controls it well. He doesn't take on anyone else, but it's just like, oh, that was pretty random.
Yeah, no, it's, I mean, look, we need to be doing a lot better than we are in understanding and helping people manage symptoms of mental illness. So
in terms of like your research and the altruism to empathy, is there anything clear that you think me and anyone else tuning in just is sort of in the dark about or needs to understand?
What does the average person need to know about altruism and empathy? I think the important thing to understand about altruism is that it's a real thing. I know there's a subset of people out there who don't believe that it's possible for anybody to ever be truly altruistic. And just know that there's a strong relationship between that belief and one's own personality. So people who are themselves relatively selfish have trouble understanding that other people could be actually unselfish. So just keep that in mind if you are talking to somebody who's like, I believe everybody's fundamentally selfish. It's like, I don't think that says much about people, but it says a lot about you.
I remember hearing some people say like, without religion, what's to stop people from murdering everybody else? And it's like, well, because I don't want to murder everybody else.
Most people, I guess I'll leave you with this, is most people truly have the capacity to care about others. And it may be overwhelmed by other motivations or other emotions at any given moment, but most people have, you know, the capacity for deep goodness within them. And I think the job of a healthy society is to try to promote it and make it as easy as possible to be the good kind of person that most of us can be.
And that was Dr. Abigail Marsh. To see more information about her, be sure to click a link in the description below. If you're tuning in through the radio, I highly recommend you check out the podcast. It helps me a lot more. You can go to the podcast at podcasttheway.com. And for those people, give a 5-star rating, like, share, review the show. Every little bit makes a big difference. I really appreciate it. You can find information at podcasttheway.com. And as always, deuces.
This has been The Way Podcast. If you want to know more about The Way Podcast, go to podcasttheway.com.